Dave's Psych Lectures, part of the Thunderbird 6 podcasting network.
Okay, so today we'll finish off the stuff on navigation, and then we'll talk about foraging. As I said the other day, I wouldn't worry that we're ahead of where we are, because I have a whole bunch of other ones sort of in reserve. What I might do is I'll give you a few ideas of different topics I can give lectures on, and then you can pick some. There's a couple I want to do, so I might say, we're going to do this, and then hey, here's a choice of a couple others. So we might do something like that. By the way, the sign-up sheet for the presentation is outside my door, across the hall from me, you know, Paul's office is in the little lab area there, right there. It's on the thing. So two people per day. So sign up. Once your topic is approved for your paper/presentation, just sign up. And we'll go from there. All right. We talked about the B stuff last time. And I mentioned Ken Chen, who was one of the key guys in all this stuff. Today we can talk about the stuff that Ken did. There's Ken right there, looking at some bees. This is work he did in 1980. Not well. He published in 89, did this work mostly in 88. I know that because he was a postdoc in Bill Roberts' lab, and I was doing my honors thesis with Nancy Innes, and also I was a summer internship student with Bill Roberts. So I was in all the time, and so was Ken, and that was when we all first met Ken. Basically, it worked like this. He had a box, a cardboard box, that wide. So a couple of meters wide, square. And it had sawdust on the floor. And there was a landmark. It was just a blue stripe. And it was a blue stripe on the wall. I couldn't really make a three-dimensional diagram here, so let's just pretend that that's up on the wall. So he's got this blue stripe on the wall. The room itself is dark except for a single light over top of this, I guess you want to call it an arena. Okay, so over top of the arena, there's a single light bulb and nice even sawdust and then some grain buried in the sawdust. He led pigeons into the room from different parts. I think he randomly selected if it was starting here, here, or here. And the bird very quickly learned, because what pigeons do, they start pecking at the ground looking for food, because they're a little hungry. Eventually they find out where the goal is, and there's a landmark. This should remind you a great deal of the stuff that him and Cartwright and all these guys did with bees. It's almost exactly the same. So what he's got then is he trains them up, and they get pretty good at this pretty quickly, which shouldn't surprise him. The question is, are they using this blue stripe as a landmark? So if he moved the landmark, remember before it was here, now he moves it over to the left a little bit, and then he looks at where they search. And as you can see here, the animal searched along the same axis as the landmark shift. So the left, we can call this the left-right axis. Okay? Now, they don't completely follow the landmark, because if they did, they would have just moved their search over to the left right here. What they did is they're using that landmark and obviously other landmarks in the arena. Do you understand why they must be doing that? Because had they only been using the blue landmark, or the blue stripe, they would have just moved along to where the blue stripe was. But they don't. The searching gets kind of stretched out. But it doesn't move any other way. It moves along the same axis as the landmark shift. Okay? Now, so it doesn't shift in the other direction at all. It just shifts left, right. Because the one landmark, the notion here is then the one landmark is moving to the left and the right. So the shift will be along that same axis of the shift. Now, if you move the landmark out, so it's a piece of blue Bristol board, basically. So he just moves it out off the wall as it's standing up. Now their shift goes along the up-down axis. Okay?
So, sorry, that one, they moved the Bristol board off the wall and moved it forward?
Yeah, that's right. He couldn't move it outside, of course, because the other one wouldn't see it. The thing's got edges. So he moves it out, and then their shift goes, their shift of search goes out. But it doesn't go, it doesn't just go here, where it should go, because it's that far away normally, a few centimeters away. It goes there and along here.
So it's like a bee's perception of proximity?
It's sort of, except if you remember with the bees, when you took a landmark here, and they searched here, if you made it twice the size, they searched twice as far away here, and when they had two landmarks, if you remember the bees, if the original training was like this, and you just rotated it, they searched here. On the other hand, if you pull these two apart, then that is kind of less like the bees, because they actually get three peak places of searching if you stretch it apart. Like that, they search here, here, and here. So it's somewhat like the bees. And in fact, I think Ken was probably expecting it to be like the bees. But what the bees did, of course, if they were also if they were using the scratch test, and the bees, in fact, is probably the most important one. Because if they were using angle and distance, they should really be searching here. Right? Because that's the right angle for both. It's not a right angle. It's the correct angle for both landmarks. And in fact, they didn't ever search there. So they weren't just using angle. They were using angle from one landmark or angle from the other landmark and in the middle. Right? Of course, the point, you should always remember that in nature, this doesn't happen. So it's a perfectly acceptable solution. Landmarks don't get shifted like that, usually. But with the pigeons, it was quite a bit different. Pull it out, they search, but along an axis. So, again, before I go on, any questions about that? So Kent came up with what he called the vector sum model. And he concluded that the pigeons must be adding a self to goal and goal and goal to landmark vectors. And then determining where to search. So, let's go back, take a look. The original landmark was here. The animal knows, has learned, that there's a distance from the landmark to the goal. And that's a vector. It's got direction and distance. There also are other landmarks in the box. Can you figure out what those might be? Corners. Exactly. The corners are going to be pretty good. So in this case, the corners all point there, there. This one points there, and that's kind of screwy. And this one points here and here. If you add all of those together, the solution is somewhere along here. If you shift this thing over, it's exactly the same thing. The corners all point to the right place, but this one's pointing here. If you average, if you sum those vectors together and then average them, you get peak searching along that axis. Does that make sense? Think of vectors as just arrows. Because that's really what they are. Okay? This is the only model, by the way, that would explain, and Ken tested a whole bunch of other ideas, that explain why they searched where they did. It's one of those things, too, when you look at it, you say, well, yeah, obviously. Except I remember when Ken was working on this, and he was talking about it with everybody he could find up on the seventh floor of the social science building. And he was snobby as the eighth floor, and glad that that matters. And he was showing it to you, and everything, look, it made sense what they were doing, but trying to figure out actually how they were representing it was hard. And one day on a Sunday afternoon, I was in there running my rats for my honors thesis, and I heard Ken yell, "Eureka." Because that's the kind of guy Ken Chen is. I heard him yell from his office, which was literally, I was sitting in the nice little working room with animals. You got access to the animal area for your honors thesis, but then I also got an office. I had this nice little office I could have because no one was in there. So I'm sitting in there. I was actually looking around my rats. I was taking a break. I was reading. I think I was reading the Christian Science Monitor, which is a really good newspaper. I was reading the international relations section, which I used to do. I'm reading it, and I hear this, "Eureka!" And it's like, God, Ken's weird. And I walked over to his office. "What's up?" He said, "I figured it out!" I said, "Well, I figured you figured out something. You yelled Eureka and all." And he said, "No, you don't have, look." And he starts drawing all these vectors all over the place. I went, "That's pretty cool. That makes sense." He said, "Yes, of course it makes sense, but it's taken me weeks to figure this out." It was so cool. It was one of those great moments because it's a classic paper. And it was really neat to be there, actually, and watch the guy go, literally yell Eureka. It was a really neat moment. So the idea then is they're adding these vectors. There is a downside. If you shift the landmark, not just up and down, or not just left and right. So let's say, we'll draw this up here. So the original landmark position is here. If you shift it left or right, their search goes left or right. You shift it up and down, their search goes up and down. What should happen if you shift it diagonally, according to the model? The shift of search should, exactly, Julie's correct, should be diagonal. You should get a search pattern here. And you don't. The birds actually behave as if the whole world has changed on them, and they get ready to behave. So it's not perfect. And Ken was upset by this, understandably, because the model predicts that's exactly what should happen.
What if they set up the landmark in the
How do you mean? Oh, but you could always consider it being diagonal from a corner. When you set that originally, is that what you're talking about?
Yeah.
So what would you mean? Like put it, so the original one, put it, say, here?
Yeah, shift.
But then shift it?
So instead of it being like the long sides of the landmark being parallel to the corners of the wall?
Yeah.
So that it's not, so that it already is on there. Because they're looking at the angles of the landmark mirrors.
Oh, I see what you're saying. So you're saying put the thing itself
so
at an angle.
On an angle to begin with.
So you're saying put the thing itself on an angle.
Yeah.
Okay. I wonder if you ever tried that. I don't think that would make a difference. I don't see what I think they would still.
Then you'd be training them to search on an angle to begin with, right?
They would. I bet they would use the one of the edges and just go straight from that edge down. That'd be my guess. Yeah. I think the edges are pretty important. Thing is, you're kind of getting at what Ken said was the limitation, is that the shifts to be noticed and to be paid attention to have to be along the principally what he invented a term, and he actually felt it was a bit of a cop-out, but he said along the principal axes of space. Left or right, up or down. Now, the problem here, of course, is the world doesn't have principal axes of space. Like I said to Ken, well, what would happen then in the world? He said, oh, I don't know. I said, what are the principal axes of space outside in the world, not in a room? And he laughed. Because, like, you know, there really isn't something like that. You might think, though, that if you were looking at something out in the world, you would see something, for example, like a line of trees in the distance, and that could be a principal axis, conceivably.
Unless you're in a desert,
tundra. No, exactly. So, I mean, this is a real problem with this. The idea that the animals are adding vectors, I think that most people accept that. The idea that the test only shows up when it's left, right, or up or down. I guess it's because of this principal axis thing. It's almost a landmark. The idea there's a wall on the left and a wall on the right, and then a wall in front and a wall behind you. In fact, that is a landmark. But so maybe that's why it only works there. The idea is still summing of vectors or vector averaging, which are two somewhat different things. Either of those is fine. Ken did try some neat stuff in a circle, because then, of course, the question is, what happens in a circular arena? So he had birds in a great big cylindrical arena, and he had a Coke bottle in the middle that had a blue stripe on it. And set the blue stripe there, and they would rotate it. And in that kind of situation, he did this with pigeons and with black-cap chickadees. This is when he moved to U of T as a faculty member there, and there were chickadees at U of T because everybody had chickadees. So in that case, you get a situation like this, where you've got a big round arena, and in the middle, you got a Coke bottle that had a stripe on it. Okay? Now the bird learns to search the right place. Now the thing is, this room's got other cues in it, even though you've got a circular arena, so that gets rid of your principal axis of space thing, it's in a great big aviary. He would then rotate this, just move it, and see where the search was. So if you rotate it down, say, to here, you expect, if the vector sum model is true, searching along an axis like this, straight. If it's actually averaging vectors all of everything else that's in the room, you expect, and I'm not going to go through the math here because it's really complicated stuff with radians. Do you remember that stuff? You would expect it along an arc, not a tangent. And you get the tangent. So they are adding vectors. They aren't averaging. Go read the paper if you want. It is kind of complicated. It's neat stuff. Everything that Ken does is neat and complicated. So it's pretty clear they're averaging, adding them, but that shouldn't surprise us. I think that would be exactly what we would expect. But the neat thing was, nobody said it till Ken did. And it's like, I mean, not that I'm going to compare him to Charles Darwin, but when Darwin came up with evolution by natural selection, everybody went, of course. And when this came out, everybody went, oh, yeah, of course. And it's like, yeah, but everybody's been studying this for years and no one's figured it out, and Ken just had his eureka moment. He's done some very neat stuff. One of the things he did, he works a lot with Marcia Spetch's group at University of Alberta. And one of the neat things that they've done is they've taken pigeons and they've taken pictures of outside, of a field outside by the lab. And they set up a couple of landmarks and some food. And the bird learns on a touch screen to peck, let's say it's a bench and I don't know, like a garbage can that's actually out there in the field. Like it's not a field, but like a little area where on campus kind of thing. Like there's a little courtyard, that kind of thing. It's that kind of deal. And what they did is they just trained the bird. Eventually, when it pecked, the birds, they start pecking. Eventually, when it pecked at that place on the screen, it got food. Then what did they do? They take it outside. And they see where the birds go search outside. And they search exactly where you'd expect them to if they actually saw those pictures as representations of the real world. And they basically add the vectors from the park bench and the garbage can, and they search in that place out in the real world, even though they were only trained to do that in the lab on a touch screen, on a screen this big.
It's cool.
It's very cool, yeah. It's one of those things, too, those of us that were studying sort of avian cognition, birds' vision works differently than ours. It's, as was pointed out in that video we saw about the dinosaurs and the birds, it works. It's been better than ours in a lot of respects. the question always was, when you show a bird a picture, does it think of it as a representation of the real world, or does it just see something completely different? And many of us, myself included, thought, they just see this. It's a picture of the real world. I think that they recognize it as a picture of the real world. And then other people said, you have no evidence for that. And of course, they were right. This and a whole bunch of other, that was the neatest one, it seemed to me, because it wasn't just that you could show them an object and they recognized it. They could recognize it as a representation of an area and learn where food was. So it seems to me that kind of work completely, it should have, that hasn't, but it should have ended the debate. Do, when birds see something on a screen, do they actually think of it as a representation of the real world? I would debate this with a buddy of mine actually all the time, and he never believed it, and I don't know why. Rob Wilson. Rob and I had a deal when we were in graduate school. Every paper we would ever write, we would cite each other. It was a paper he wrote with his PhD supervisor. It just, and for no reason at the end, it says, but see Brodbeck and Shuttleworth. It's like, thanks. He took it seriously. I was kidding. I said, we'll cite each other all the time. I did cite him a couple of times, but it was because it was relevant. I don't know what that, his thing aside, I can't remember. I think it was about chickeny associative memory. He was doing something. Parallel distributed processing models? If, I don't know. Just threw it in at the end. I really appreciated it. Anyway, questions about this stuff? It's pretty cool. So this shows how birds and bees, and et cetera, can navigate on the short term.
The long term? How do they do things like, oh, I don't know, navigate?
How do homing pigeons home?
They're probably using the magnetic sense of the Earth. They're probably using snow.
Locally, they'd use this kind of thing. So, homing pigeon. He's out. You take him very far away. Yes, then I'll fly home. You take him to a place he's never been, and he gets home. How the hell does he get home? Yeah.
Didn't you say something? I know I did a presentation on this last year. Mm-hmm. It said something about like the compass that they have.
Yep.
Kind of like when you move them, they kind of remember which way they're going.
There is a guess that, well, we know that pigeons have cells in their, in their brain, that are sensitive to the magnetic field of the Earth. That's, we have, they have those, okay? So as long as they know what heading they're supposed to be on, they can get to the right place, and then eventually, once they're at the right place, they can then use something like this and say, okay, that's exactly home. The neat thing is, when you take a look at where those cells project, they actually project into the visual system of the pigeon, which tells us then that if those cells, when they fire, depending on the magnetic field of the Earth, that tells us, in fact, that the bird is getting a visual experience of a compass. In other words, they got a heads-up display. Just like you would see in a really high-end car or in a fighter jet or something, where they actually see lines showing where north is. And if you don't think that's cool, you don't know what cool is.
I thought I read that terns or deterrents had something in their beaks that helped them.
I've heard that too.
They migrate further, I think, than any other place.
Oh, God. I mean, you take a look
at Antarctica
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah. And there's also turtles that are pretty clearly doing this as well. Sea turtles that migrate thousands and thousands of kilometers. And if you look at, they have these magnetic cells. And they're actually getting, through both the magnetic, they get magnetic information that will give you north-south. They also, because of, what is it? I can't remember. It's to do, I believe, with polarized light. We'll give you west-east. And what they're getting actually is blue.
Stuff we don't, you know, stuff we had to invent stuff to do this. And these animals are actually getting it as a heads-up display when they're walking around. You know, it's like Terminator, right? And they can see stuff. It's awesome.
Especially like ocean animals.
Oh, yeah.
Like, talk about having no landmarks. There's nothing in the ocean that you would.
Yeah, I mean, again, short term navigation, things like finding food in an area you live in, for sure. And if you're pretty deep, there really aren't a whole lot of landmarks. Now, you could, on the other hand, be sensitive to things, as you said, like the magnetic poles of the earth, things like that. So, yeah, it would make a great deal of sense for that to have evolved. The idea, though, is that it's not just that they have a feeling. Like, you know, you're better than chance at pointing where north is. You'd be surprised about this, but humans are better than chance even in a room, and they've been disoriented, and you get them into a room with no outside light, say like this one, that they've never been in before. You turn the lights off, the whole thing, and then you say, point to north, and you're better than chance at that. Like, we have a sense, some kind of magnetic sense. It's not very strong. Right? But we just have a feeling, whereas things like perhaps sea turtles and pigeons, for example, turns, are able to go, oh yeah, well I just got to line that up with the grid reference I'm seeing in front of me. It's like freaking Tron, except it's good. Well, the first Tron was pretty good. The second one, that's a little weak. It was quite cool. Other things we don't know how, like salmon, how they get home?
Well, nobody has any idea.
Well, we have guesses. Well, they can smell. Like, I mean, we really don't know. Just one knows, everybody follows them. So conclusions are about navigation. Animals obviously use a lot of sources of information. We've got everything from these local landmarks all the way to and beacons and path integration. Then we can talk about things like magnetic sense. The nice thing is, as I mentioned a couple of times, these multiple sources almost always point, and I should put that sort of in quotes because they aren't always really pointing, but they always point to the same place. I think the representation itself here is going to be hierarchical, such that we know that certain things are thought of as being more important than other things, depending on the species. So maybe the spatial relationships are more important than color, and that's going to be something you'd expect anyway. If you were, say, a food-storing bird, I've talked about this before, you would really pay attention to spatial relationships and, in fact, ignore color if you could. And path integration and landmark use and beacons and all these things together, as I talked about the idea of searching for where the Hockey Hall of Fame was in Toronto. If you've got the sun, you can use a sun compass. You've also got your sense of where north and south are. Let's say you're north, let's say you're Young and Bloor in Toronto, and you want to get to the Hockey Hall of Fame. And you know that it's on Front Street, so you have a map-like representation in your head. You've also got the beacon of the CN Tower, which acts as a landmark as well, because you know it's a few hundred meters north of the CN Tower. You know that you have to go south because you're north, because you're Young and Bloor. All these things point to the same place normally. And the way we find out which things animals are using is that we start screwing with them. We start messing up one set of cues or put cues in competition and see which one they follow. Questions about that stuff? I think it's cool. Well, I know it's cool. So again, for those of you that came in a little later, remember that the sign-up sheet is up for presentations.
When do they start again?
The 7th of November. Oh, by the way, also before the class, you know, get them all. Get your time picked. There's two per day. If there's a day where we don't have any, we don't have to meet, because it seems to me we're not always going to stand here. Right, so look in advance. You can always check with me, but if I don't see anything, and please do sign up. Get your topic approved and sign up soon if you could. It's going to help everyone.
Yes.
You can't just pick a day.
Can we change our topic?
If you check with me in advance, yes. Of course. I'll approve almost anything, by the way. I really will, but you want to check with me first. Like if you just say, I want to do identification of criminals. Well, that's not anything to do with this class. We'll talk to Paul and his little science. Paul said the other day he was talking, like the first day of, I think, what was it? Is he teaching socialist here?
Yeah.
Yeah. He said the first day he was making fun of me and the students who didn't know him and like, came just out of first year were like all shocked that he was making fun of me. But so he does about, makes it really, you know, makes it fun. People didn't think, people think he's serious. It's great. All right. So let's move on and talk about foraging. Pointer. Here we go. Animal spaces are the problems when it comes to getting food. Foraging means going after food, looking for food. Here's some questions an animal could ask itself. And I mean ask itself, not really that it's sitting there thinking, okay? Again, it's a short game. What should I eat? Or should I eat at all? Is it worth eating this thing? Right? Or should I do something else? Deciding to eat, deciding what to eat, which is the same as what should be eaten. I don't know why I have that twice. Deciding when to stop. Might make sense to go somewhere else after a while. Maybe that you've exhausted all the food here. I like to think of this kind of like when you're out and you're thinking to yourself. Think about when you're in the different situations when you want to get something to eat. And you're out by yourself with friends, doesn't matter. When I'm feeling a little hungry, should I stop and get something to eat? Or should I wait till I get home and cook dinner? You could ask yourself, should I go here, even though this food I know isn't very good, but maybe I'm exceedingly hungry. So you're walking along, you think, I'm really, really hungry. But the only thing around here is country-style donuts. Do I really want to go there? Or even worse, Arby's.
What?
Does anybody go to Arby's?
I love Arby's.
People go to Arby's?
It's expensive.
People must go to Arby's because it's still open. But I went once in 1977 and that was enough for me.
The curly fries? Come on.
Yeah, okay. But most people, well, think about it. It's even a joke in Seinfeld when Putty says, it feels like an Arby's night. And he's thought I was an idiot. So, I'm always afraid one day I'm going to get something. My parents own the Arby's in town. And it's still open. They must be doing okay. Or you think, well, I skip that and go somewhere else. Right? So it depends on, for example, it's going to depend on how hungry you are. Right? It's going to depend on, is it something you like? It gets to the point, you're so hungry, it doesn't even matter if you don't like it that much. It's like, whatever, but God, I'm hungry. It's like when you're driving along on the highway and you think, well, there's no towns for another 100 kilometers. I've got to stop at this horrible place. Well, I guess we'll just stop at this gas station and get a lot of chips. Right? Float up on Pringles. And finally, you've got to find the food itself. The food itself might be hidden. Right? So maybe the case that you have to go searching, it's not out in the open. So these are the kind of decisions that animals have to make. And we can think about these decisions both within an animal's lifetime, and we can think about it over evolutionary time. Because different animals have different diets. You would guess that this has been done almost, a whole lot of this stuff has been done using optimality models. Because if you're making the decision, what should I eat? Well, what's the right thing to eat? When should I stop eating, etc. The same kind of ideas we looked at mobbing when we talked about adaptation. We have that same kind of thing. Cost versus benefits. Because think of it, if the food itself is a great cost, maybe it's something you have to open. Right? So let's say you're a seabird and you have to open a shellfish. That's costly. Costly meaning it takes time. It takes energy. And while you're busy trying to open up that muscle or clam, maybe you're vulnerable to predation. That's a lot of cost. But maybe when you open up that muscle or clam, it's got all kinds of nutrients. And it's delicious. Because it is, after all, seafood. So optimality models, as you know, are all about cost and benefits. So we have to look at what the costs are, what the benefits are. Does it make sense? So how do these things work? Excuse me. The first thing you have to look at for any optimality model is you got to look at what the decision is that the animal's making. And remember, with mobbing, it was to mob or not to mob, as Shakespeare said. So where should an animal feed would be a question, the decision. Or how long should it stay? Should it stay or should it go? Now we have Shakespeare and The Clash being referenced, one after the other. What food should it eat? Maybe there's a choice of food. It could be a choice, as I said, or it could be an evolutionary decision. So you can look at a moment-to-moment within animals' lifetime choice, and we'll talk about that kind of stuff. We can also look at the evolutionary decision that has been made. It could be something like deciding to leave an area, that's a choice within an animal's lifetime, or it could decide to evolve a mechanism to detoxify a plant. Right? So you might say, when will that happen? Well, that will happen if the following things are satisfied over evolutionary time, and that would be, of course, the cost that we have the benefits, and you gotta figure out what the cost and benefits are. Finally, here's another one. Decide how long your chewing teeth should be. Now again, that's an evolutionary decision. But it's still a decision. When you take a look at, and that's actually something a lot of people have looked at tooth length. It's oddly enough, maybe you wouldn't be surprised. It's actually been, over the years, kind of a hot area of research, because you use the comparative method and you say, what kind of diet goes with what kind of teeth? And you would think, well, that's going to be a very important thing, but in fact, the more important thing very often isn't the kind of diet, it's the kind of mating system. So a lot of times you look at something and say, well, clearly they must eat a lot of meat because they got great big fangs, big canine teeth. And in fact, it turns out that really only the males have big canine teeth, and it only happens when there's a polygynous mating system, one male, many females, which means the males bite each other. It's got nothing to do so much with what they eat, and that's been looked at among a lot of different apes and monkeys. Okay. So the first thing you have to do is you have to make assumptions about, well, the first thing is the decision. Then you have to make an assumption about the currency. Now the currency here is a fitness correlated variable, whatever that variable may be. Remember I said at the end of the day, a lot of this stuff about optimality models should remind you of economics. And it's had a large impact. The difference is that economics actually predicts things in biology, unlike, say, all economics. No, everything will be fine. Economy's fine. It's great. Uh-oh. So, maybe the currency you're going to look at is maximizing energy gain. That sounds like a pretty good currency. What's the nice thing we can do here? Well, if we're looking at energy gain, we can measure energy. We can measure it in calories. Right? Like, this is something, we can put real numbers into something like this and make a very precise prediction. minimizing travel time. If the animal is a species that is one that forages in a patchy environment, so, you know, not like a monkey in South America. Monkeys in South America live up in the forest canopy. It's not a patchy environment. There's food everywhere. There's just fruit on trees. You go from tree to tree and you eat all day. Which is one of the reasons I always figured that monkeys are stupid. Like, New World monkeys are kind of slow. It's always struck me. I know they're not stupid. Well, compared to humans, they are. But I mean, when you compare New World monkeys and Old World monkeys, a lot of times the Old World monkeys do a little bit better in cognitive tests. And newer monkeys live in the forest canopy of South America, where you just literally hang out all day and eat ripe fruit. It's actually not a bad life, except if you're a monkey. That's not a patchy environment. Compare that to something like, or a lot of grazing animals, also one that doesn't, it's not a patchy environment. Right? Like a cow. I'm going to walk around all day in this thing full of grass and eat the grass. You live on your food. There's food everywhere. You compare that to something that has to hunt, or something that eats a rare kind of food, right?
I always think of caribou eating lichen in the tundra and migrating like
right.
almost thousands of kilometers. I work with a lichenologist this summer. We took go collect certain
right.
lichen samples and like baggies. And you know how long it takes to fill a baggie with lichen? And it's nothing. It's like 20
yeah.
grams of lichen. They eat like
30
pounds of
it. Oh, but they have to.
Like, it's incredible.
Yeah, and when you look at something like that where the migration is probably driven by the fact that there's no food at certain times either. Right? So then you got to go somewhere else. Because if you stay up here, stay up up in the far north and it starts to, you can't see the lichen. Because it's covered in snow. And it's dead. Right? So, I mean, it's an amazing thing when you look, when you think about these animals that have these. But once they get to the tundra and it's. The summer, they just eat, right? It's everywhere.
They
it's not
migrating. Like they go,
they move from place to place all the time. But yeah, right. Think about something like, like a bear, right? Eating berries, things like that. They have to travel around all the time. Now let's say you find a really good bush. You got like, it's got all kinds of little wild raspberries. You're eating them. At some point, you got to leave and go to another raspberry bush. And it's not like bushes have been planted nicely in rows like they are at pick-your-own-raspberry places. This is out in the bush, right? So you've got to make a decision. Do I leave, or maybe I go steal a picnic basket? There we go. Now a little Yogi Bear reference. I hated Yogi Bear, by the way. It's one of the cartoons I didn't like. I was kind of hoping the ranger would just shoot it. Here's one. Probability of survival until nightfall. Oh boy, that's pretty intense. Yes, you would like to maximize that one. Because think about it. If you got there's a lot of birds that, like little songbirds, they can't carry a lot of fat. Because if they do, they can't fly very well. If you don't fly well, you get caught by animals and eaten. So you've got to be as light as possible during the day, but at night you've got to lay down fat. So in the morning, they will eat very quickly because if they don't, they'll die. Okay, like little songbird, like right now, you see like all these, most of the songbirds have left, but things like chickadees are still around. They don't eat about 30, 40 minutes after they wake up. They literally starve to death. And they eat just enough to keep going, and then they'll lay down fat just before the night goes, before they go to sleep. You want to be able to make it till nightfall. But you want to be just heavy enough that you live. Because if you're too heavy, you can't fly very well and you die. Oh, nature's perfect, isn't it, Gray? No. Nature is ready to claw. Things die. Things kill each other. I want to live naturally. I don't.
Hey, Dave, what if they have, like, free access to food, like a bird feeder or something?
Mm-hmm.
Will chickadees just, like, store it, or will
mm-hmm.
they...
Exactly.
Okay, because they're, like, always, like, my parents just, like, eat all day, but I guess they're just, like, taking away...
Then they take it away. If you watch, in the morning, they'll be doing a lot more standing around and eating, and then they'll carry them away more during the day. In the morning, what they're doing is they're eating. And also later in the day, which is toward dusk, they'll start eating them. But during the day, they're taking those nuts, those seeds, you know, whatever the hell you've got in that thing, and they're storing that food. So the next morning, what they'll do very often is the first thing they do is they wake up and they'll go recover some sort of food, especially if it's snowed, things like that, and it's hard to find the food site. Yeah. And if they, like I said, if they don't do it, they literally die. We would take our chickadees. You never had to really worry about food-depriving birds, these little birds, because they kind of are built that way. So you take their little food dish away at night, so they would work hard in the morning. They'd wake up and be like, oh, Dave's here. I get to go peck at a little feeder that has peanuts in it. I'll get my food. We take their food away at night. You'd come in the morning, and we would start. You'd start the experiment, you know, 20 minutes after the lights came on. It was on a timer, of course. But I'll tell you, if you screwed up, if you couldn't get in one day, you had to make a phone call because you could lose an animal. You wouldn't always, but it happened to most of us where one day, you know, you waited a little too long and you see a bird all in the corner of its cage, and they would get, and you'll see this if you look at, it's very, most of you probably go around looking at birds at night, but they get all puffed up to keep themselves warm. That's the function of that. So they get their feathers all puffed up and their heartbeat slows down. It's all this stuff to basically, it's not a hibernation, but it's a way to try to stay alive and try to stay warm. And we had around what we called the avian first aid kit, which was sugar, water, and a syringe. And what you do, when you saw a bird like that, you saw one of your birds like that, you take them, and this was one of the times, it's not usually easy to just put your hand in a cage and grab a chickadee. When they're like that, it's not that hard. And you would just take them in your hand, and you'd feel this heart beating, you know, literally 400 times a minute. So it's amazing. And that's when it's slow. And you take this super saturated sugar solution and just inject it right into their mouths and hope that it would go, and it would go straight down because birds are built that way. You can't make a bird drown like that. It doesn't work quite the same way. That's why force-feeding birds, force-feeding ducks, corn to make foie gras actually isn't evil. It's just delicious. They don't gag. They don't choke. So you do that and hope that was enough energy for them, and then you put them under a heat lamp. And about half the time, you'd still lose them. It's a horrible, horrible thing. Of course, they'd also have to get over the fact that it's frightening for them. So usually if they got past the you holding them, if they're going to die, they'll die in your hand. Because it's so frightening for them, they have a heart attack. But it's either that or just let them die. We didn't lose a lot. I probably lost two birds the whole time I did my research, which was a horrible experience. You feel like I took this thing from the world, and I was responsible for it, and now I've killed it. Never bothered you? It was like, we got to kill these things and look at their brains. Like, okay. That never really bothered me that much, but when you do it, it's really upsetting. We used to have, my friend Rob and I had this little thing. We wouldn't eat for a day. It was like a little nod to the bird, you know? Which, I mean, didn't bring the bird back. Let's leave them calories per hour. Let's maximize calories per hour. Whatever. So this is the kind of thing you're looking at. That's the currency you're looking at. And these are all clearly fitness related, especially survival until mental. Now finally, you have to make assumptions about the constraints there are on your decision, on your model, etc. For example, what fixed properties of the animal? Not example. What fixed properties of the animal? What are the environment affect the decision? There's got to be some fixed properties of the animal or the environment that affect your decision or its decision. So, how much energy can you get out of giving food? Considering their diet, it would be great if you could feed an animal, I don't know, well, there you go, sugar. I mean, this is the reason we would use just concentrated sugar solution, is that it's nothing but energy. Is there anything like that in the world that a chickadee can get? No. So you got to say, look, the limit of what it can get per food item is this. That's just how the world works. What's the encounter rate with the food? So how often does that food item show up? for example, how quickly the nectar sources remove themselves. Think about this. We talked about the honey creepers the other day. If you look at a nectar-feeding bird, they are getting sugar water. It's kind of watered down, but it's pretty good. But you can't just stay in the same place, and you've got to go stay away from there usually for 24 hours, because if you drain the nectar has to renew. Those flowers are not just nectar machines. It's not like an open bar. Right? It's got to be renewed. How often do you encounter a man-eating shark? In other words, you've got to look at predation, perhaps, as well. So you've got to look at all this stuff as constraints on your model. Now, our goal is to determine what decision, given the constraints, maximizes the currency. Now, this model itself now will almost always be quantitative. In other words, it will give you numbers. And if you remember, those of you who took learning, remember the Rescorla-Wagner model, it was quantitative, except that the numbers it gave you were units of learning, which wasn't really... It made the curves look nice, and it predicted a lot of great stuff, but it didn't really give you anything. And you'd make a lot of what salience you would make guesses about what the numbers were. Here we're actually going to be able to make exact predictions about what an animal should do. You'll hear sometimes some people say that evolution isn't testable, that evolutionary theory isn't testable. Well, those people are wrong. We can observe it in the world, and we can also observe how its predictions, which all the Melody models talk about, are from evolutionary theory, make precise quantitative predictions. All right, does this make sense? Questions so far? Stuff here has been done by Bilofsky, and I think that's a she. Taking a look at a lot of different species and making predictions about diet selection. And here's a question, and I think she's a she. How much aquatic vegetation should a moose eat? The constraints include sodium. The animal has to get a certain amount of sodium, okay, each day. And there's a sodium constraint. In other words, without that sodium, the animal is going to, it's a nutrient the animal needs. And the size of its rumen. A rumen's like a stomach, except it's a stomach that ferments stuff, okay? Now, that's a constraint, because you can't get any more food in your gut than your gut will hold. So we take a look here, and we've got intake of aquatic plants and intake of terrestrial plants. You take a look here, terrestrial plants don't have any sodium in them. They have to eat some aquatic vegetation because it has sodium in it. There's a problem with aquatic plants, though. They take up space because they're soggy. Right? So the animal must eat at least this much, this the dashed line here, aquatic plants. Anything below that, and it's not getting enough sodium. Okay? And then depending on the amount of terrestrial versus aquatic plants, this is how much its gut can hold. And you can see here, if they eat nothing but aquatic plants, it's only this much, but nothing but terrestrial plants is that much. In other words, well, they're soggy. They take up a lot of space.
It looks kind of like the opposite on that. Like they can hold more aquatic.
They can hold more terrestrial. See, look, because it's way up here.
Okay.
You see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And then there's an energy constraint. they need a certain amount of energy to maintain their weight. Now you can see here there's more energy from aquatic plants than there are from terrestrial plants. I don't know why, that's some characteristic of the plants moose eat. So we've got these three curves. Remember back when you were in grade, oh, I don't know, 10? Solving systems of equations? And you find out where three curves met or where two curves met, and you find out things like, well, what's the area between these three lines? Did you not do this? Did I teach you anything in math anymore? No? Okay, just adding is mostly all you do now? All the grade, and if you're in the advanced one in grade 12, you subtract? Is that what happens now? You can see here, though, it's going to have to be somewhere in this scalene triangle. It's a scalene triangle, isn't it? Am I wrong? They don't teach you about triangles anymore either, do they? They teach no geometry. I mean, I get the idea. You can look a lot of stuff up, but that's a scalene triangle. Anyway. So you'd expect it to be somewhere, this is what Bilofsky said, it has to be somewhere in this square. That's going to be a solution. I don't like that noise. Now, what ends up happening, in fact, is the aspirant points out exactly what the moose do. Is that what they're doing is they're maximizing they're going along the sodium constraint, not below it. And they're getting as many terrestrial plants as possible. As you can see, this is as far away as it could be. Because terrestrial plants are probably easier to eat. Right? You also don't have to be in the water where maybe you, not that moose have a whole lot of predators, except people. So I wouldn't worry about that. But the thing is, I don't know, it's probably colder in the water. You're standing in water eating, that doesn't sound good. I'd rather be out in the forest. Sure. So what they're doing is they're maximizing the terrestrial plants they're eating. They're eating the minimum amount, in fact, of aquatic vegetation if they have to. It's probably more work as well. Right? So that's pretty cool. You see that worked? And this is actually not really that hard to do. You've got to sit there and realize what the important constraints are, and one obviously is going to be how big your gut is.
How did she quantify the amount of food that they're eating?
Oh, she measured it. She was actually...
Like, was she looking at carcasses? Or she...
Oh, no, she was just watching them eat and making guesses from what I remember.
Because when they eat aquatic vegetation, usually it's under the water.
Yeah.
So isn't it...
Yeah, so I don't actually know in that case. Yeah, I mean, why you can certainly do it from eating regular vegetation out of it, watching them eat leaves and stuff and grasses, but the aquatic vegetation, I'm not sure. One of the neat things that she has done, there's another one with squirrels that I don't have here, and I actually forget what the decision was. But in that case, same sort of thing. She actually made these precise predictions. And when, the neat thing what she does, unlike a lot of people who do off Malley theory, is she now goes out into the world and sees if her predictions are accurate. And she's been pretty good at this. But yeah, I don't know. I haven't read that paper in a long time. In fact, I remember when I was making this slide and I couldn't find this graph. Couldn't find it anywhere. And I emailed a friend of mine at Western. I said, you know that Bilofsky thing with the moose? You have a graph of that anywhere? And he faxed it to me. So clearly, so it worked out. Because he just had an old piece. And he said, I think it's this one. I'll fax it to you. Oh, okay. You could email it. No. Not a scanner. Okay. So that's one example. Now we can get into something that is not about specific species. It's about everybody. Everybody that eats in a patchy environment. This is something that Chernoff came up with in 1976, and it's called the marginal value theorem. Note how mathy this sounds, because it's math. Okay, If the profitability of a food item, that's energy, equals energy, sorry, that's the profitability, that's how much you get at it, equals the energy divided by its handling time. So P equals E divided by H. Does that make sense? So the longer it takes to eat something, that could include opening it up, that could include how long it takes to chew it, whatever. So it's just handling time. And E is the energy. So what this, first of all, you think about that and say, a profitable food item is going to be one where either E is really high or H is really low, and the ultimate one is going to be when E is really high and H is really, really low. So if you got a food item that you don't get much out of, but you don't have to do anything to it, P is going to be high. If you got something where you have to work your ass off at it, but inside it is like a big knob of butter, well, that's pretty good too. Now, the question is, when should an animal leave a patch of food? This is the patchy environment. This is not the constant, you know, canopy of the Amazon, or Camazon, as I used to say. It's a word I've invented. The animal should leave a food patch when the profitability of a current patch equals the profitability of all patches divided by the number of patches. In other words, it should leave when the profitability of the current patch equals P bar, the average profitability of any patch, because it's the profitability of all patches divided by the number of patches. Nope, we're looking at this saying, who cares? Did I say anything yet about animals can do averages? No. This is not a cognitive question. This is what an animal should do. I'm sucking the air out of here or something.
You can explain that.
Yeah. So, when should you go? Well, you don't profit with your current patch would be. That's okay? Now, when should you leave? Well, you should leave as soon as going somewhere else is better. When is somewhere else going to be better? Well, you know it's going to be better when what you're getting from this place equals the average amount you get from any place. Why should you leave then? Because the next bite of food you take means that now this is lower than the average. So what it's saying is I should leave when this has become an average food patch. Because as soon as it's average, the next bite of food I take means it's below average. I should have left already. I've just wasted time. Does that make sense? Yeah, please.
So it's taking a piece of food like from an amount that's there and it leaves a certain amount. So it becomes like, it doesn't diminish the food there too much, or are you saying it will sort of make a prediction that the next food patch that I go to must be this one?
Will be as good as what I'm getting right now. But if anything more I eat from here, the rate of return, the profitability from this food patch I made now, because now we've hit the average, now by definition I must be lower than average for this next bite. So this next bite of anything.
Why doesn't it want to go? Why does it not want to get down?
Because I can get more over there. The profitability is better over there. Why should I stay here? Right? So think of it this way. Think of it if it's if there were, I don't know, cookies all over the room. Okay? And you're at a place where there's six cookies. And there's five there and five there. You eat the first cookie, you're at five. You should actually, at this point, maybe have the next one, but after that you really should leave because there's more cookies here and here. Right? So you should leave right at the point when you're hitting the average, because there's no reason to stay anymore, because the next bite of food I take means now this is a below average food patch. And the difference between being like cookies and an animal in the world is you've already eaten today and you don't have any chance of starving to death. Right? Yeah, please.
So the animal companies now based on their experiences?
We don't know. We'll get there. But that's a very good question. You're thinking like a psychologist, which is a good thing.
You're not thinking like a theoretical population biologist that says, I don't give a shit. Now, let's look for the mathematically inclined. If this doesn't make any sense to you, don't worry about it. There's also going to be travel time. So I didn't factor in the fact that to go from one set of cookies to another is going to take some time, and we have to throw that in. The longer time you spend in the patch, the gains, in other words, see, this is the energy gain, it starts to even out because you can't get any more food. And what you want to do is maximize the net gain. So what you're doing here, in fact, is you're finding out the slope of this curve from zero is the highest. Whoops. You're going to stay longer if you had to travel longer. Well, I'm glad that's done. If this doesn't help you a whole lot, don't worry. Like I said, if you're mathematically inclined, I hope you can all see that the calculus eventually plays a very big role in how this stuff works. Because we're looking at the slope of a curve. And we want to maximize that slope. And you might ask yourself, are the birds that are doing this using calculus? Well, of course they're not doing calculus. But calculus represents, shows us how they make the decisions. All the slopes occurs at given points. So I just got to put that as an aside. If you're mathematically inclined, you can look at that and go, oh yeah. If you're not, don't worry about it. And here's what we're getting at, what you guys are saying. The animal should know P for every patch in the environment. Because how's it going to get the average? I got no in quotes there. The animal must know P, E, and E for each patch. Sorry. If it knows P, it means it has to know E and H for each patch. And the question then, this is what you were asking, is how do they do this? Because you know what the neat thing is? They actually do this. Animals in patchy environments behave just as the Marshall Value Theorem predicts. As odd as that sounds, they do what you would expect them to do based on the marginal value theorem. Well, there's a couple of possibilities here. The biggest one is probably just a rule of thumb. Now, they could actually be doing the math. That's possible. It seems not horribly likely, but it's possible. That's one solution. Here's a better solution. They're called rules of thumb. A rule of thumb is just, not a rule of thumb, it's an expression. Just like, don't sleep in the subway, darling. That's a rule of thumb. Don't sleep in the subway. 2 o'clock, ladies and gentlemen. Always wear pants. For example, rule of thumb at this university is classes end 10 minutes, 15 minutes before they're scheduled due. Technically, supposedly, on the schedule, this says 10 to 11:30. We don't go to 11:30. We might go to 11:20, usually 11:15, sometimes less. It's a rule of thumb. Right? Give you time to get to your next class, give the next person time to come in here and set up, etc. So here's a rule of thumb. Giving up time. In other words, if I haven't encountered food in X number of seconds, I leave. So after a little while, and it might be different for each animal, and of course it could change depending upon the rate of return in the environment. So if the last few days you haven't been getting very much food, your giving up time is going to be pretty long, because it's like, there's not a lot of food around. And I've learned that the average rate of return is pretty low. ROBL stands for run of bad luck. In other words, I've just had a few tries finding food, and I haven't. And it's not like it's bad luck, necessarily. There isn't any food left here. So these rules of thumb, a lot of them are thought up by Al Campbell, and you've heard me talk about Al Campbell before when we talked about learning. And Al has one of the greatest cutesy titles ever for a paper. It's called Rules to Leave By. It's about patch leaving behavior. So that was very clever. One day I want to be famous enough that I can make a clever title of a paper. So what's the psychologist to do? Because the biologist looks at this and says, I don't really care. This shows what animals do. Well, it's like with Pulaski, right? I don't know how, I don't, she knows how they're making that decision. That's what they do. The psychologist's question is, how do these kind of things show up? Right? How do the animals actually follow these rules? So the fortune models need to provide precise predictions about results, but they give us clues about what an animal should do, but they don't say much about mechanism. Psychologist's task is looking at mechanisms. That's what our training is. That's what we do. Now, again, for the most part, psychologists that study animal behavior now look at cause and function, right? So look at them. And so do most biologists. So the psychologists, most of them do it, look at they are aware of all that other stuff, but more interested in mechanism. So you look at what the cognitive mechanism is. So how can an animal reach optimality? That's the question the psychologist asks. Through what mechanisms can they reach optimality? So don't get confused about this. Optimal foraging theory is about function. Right? And cognitive mechanisms are about cause. And you don't want to mix those two up. One of the neat things you can do is you can take it. There are times when optimal foraging theory makes one prediction, and cognitive mechanisms make a whole different prediction. This is something that Sarah Shuttleworth's talked about a great deal. Putting the two things, and not saying that one's right and one's wrong, but saying, why is it that the cognitive psychology says this is going to happen, and the foraging theory says this is going to happen? So remember, these are complementary, but not competing explanations. So you can look at things like, how does an animal make a choice? What kind of food it's going to have. Sarah and her students over the years looked at things like, how do animals make decisions about leaving a patch? And she's found, her and, say, Catherine Plowright at the University of Ottawa, student of Sarah, Sarah's first PhD student, found that pigeons have what's called a memory window. And what they do is they basically take the average rate of return that they've average amount of food they're getting per unit time, and they have a sort of a sliding window. So it moves along. It's like in the last, and I forget what the number is, and it changes depending upon a lot of different variables. Let's say it's 30 seconds. So how much food have I got in the last 30 seconds? Should I stay or should I go? And that window kind of slides along, and it's always 30 seconds. Okay? Now, depending on the situation, maybe the animal's hungry, so maybe that's going to change. More or less hungry, that's going to change the size of the memory window. Right? By doing that, the animal can actually follow the marginal value theorem very closely, but, and there's a mechanism to do it, the animal doesn't have to actually be constantly doing averages in its head. Right? In fact, I'd be very surprised if any animals were constantly doing averages in their head. That said, the idea of keeping track of number, like, I think I told you guys about the squirrel monkey counting stuff. Keeping track of the number of food items you've got would actually be a sensible thing to do. Because if you can keep track of the number of food items you have, you can make a decision about should I stay here or should I go somewhere else to eat. But you have to remember these are not competing explanations. And I think both psychologists and biologists have been horrible this way. Because you'll see a psychologist complaining. Psychologists complain like crazy when all this foraging theory stuff came up. Yeah, it was just the same old mechanism. And the biologists were like, yeah, I know. That's not really a problem. It's an evolutionary model. And then I've seen biologists say, well, optimal foraging theory explains behavior a whole lot better than cognitive psychology. I said, no, you're stupid. We have to both look at this stuff because both levels of explanation are good.
I've seen Sarah do it in print, which is something I wouldn't do, but she's kind of way cooler than I am academically. Like, I've seen her just call people out. It's awesome. Well, I have to. That's the kind of thing she'd say. Then she'd laugh and say, oh, well, I didn't mean it. All right, questions? All right, thanks, guys.
Podcast is released under a Creative Commons copyright, Sharealike 2.5 Canada. Feel free to redistribute the information as you see fit, but please don't make any money out of it. And if you do, you got to tell me, because I'm reserving that right. giving up all the other ones, including mash it up any way you want, okay? Also, of course, give me attribution. If you want to get a hold of me, my email address is dave.brodbeck, B-R-O-D-B-E-C-K, at algomau.ca. My website is people.auc.ca/broadbeck/blog. Most of the music, all the music's PodSafe, and most of it comes from GarageBand.com or the PodSafe Music Network. See you next time.